Welcome to The Thing About Austen, a podcast about Jane Austen's world. I'm Zan.
And I'm Diane. And this episode, we're talking about the duel in Sense and Sensibility.
The Ten Duel Commandments.
So you might be thinking, what duel? And while there's no direct mention of a duel in the novel, like the word duel is not used in the text, dueling is referenced in Sense and Sensibility. So that's what we're going to be unpacking today. At this point in the novel, we are in London, where Eleanor and Marianne are staying with Mrs. Jennings. Marianne has learned that Willoughby is to marry the wealthy heiress, Miss Grey, and is absolutely heartbroken. Colonel Brandon stops by to speak with Eleanor and to pass along knowledge of his prior dealings with Willoughby. He tells Eleanor that Willoughby seduced his young ward Eliza, abandoning her after promising to return and leaving her pregnant and alone. And then Eleanor asks Brandon if he has seen Willoughby since leaving him at Barton.
So Colonel Brandon says, "One meeting was unavoidable." Eleanor, startled by his manner, looked at him anxiously, saying, "What, have you met him too?" "I could meet him no other way. Eliza had confessed to me, though most reluctantly, the name of her lover. And when he returned to town, which was within a fortnight after myself, we met by appointment, he to defend, I to punish his conduct. We returned unwounded, and the meeting, therefore, never got abroad." Eleanor sighed over the fancied necessity of this, but to a man and a soldier, she presumed not to censure it.
So Willoughby and Brandon had a duel.
It's code, right? There's a code underlying that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Reading between the lines, they dueled. Let's start off by talking a little bit about dueling itself and where it comes from. According to Barbara Holland's book, Gentleman's Blood, A History of Dueling, the word duel is from the Latin duellum, duo plus bellum, or a war between two. Historians agree that its roots lie in the medieval trial by combat, which itself goes back a long way and rested happily on the notion that the winner would be not the stronger man, but the virtuous man. The thought process being something along the lines of good always triumphs over evil, so obviously whoever wins the duel is in the right.
Seems very logical. Obviously, this makes so much sense. The Oxford Companion to the Romantic Age goes on to give a bit more background and definition of dueling, explaining that the modern concept of the duel, with all its elaborate etiquette and connections to honor, came from 16th century Italy, and then spread throughout Europe. The duel, quote, denoted the armed conflict between two gentlemen, one of whom demanded satisfaction for a perceived harm or insult, being ready to risk his life rather than see honor or reputation compromised.
This concept of honor really is at the heart of these conflicts, and honor and masculinity in particular seem to be intricately bound together. Stephen Banks, in his article, Killing with Courtesy, The English Duelist, 1785 to 1845, explains that, quote, "Commentators on honor argued in the late 18th and early 19th centuries that no gentleman was appropriately masculine unless he accepted the tenets of honor." Oh, okay.
We just have to acknowledge that we're going to have to sigh through some of these honor codes, right? So according to Ian Mortimer, in The Time Traveler's Guide to Regency Britain, quote, "Dueling is a matter of upper-class male honor. No gentleman would deign to fight someone from the middle or working classes. It would be beneath him."
That's obviously a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but...
Yes, but it is this idea that, like, upper-class males are the only ones who are, like, formally engaging in this kind of dueling.
One of the potentially tricky things about honor in this context was that, not surprisingly, a gentleman's honor was a rather loosely defined concept, and so disputes and duels could be fought over a wide range of perceived slights. A wide range of perceived slights.
Heavy emphasis there.
Yes.
So dueling was initially combat with swords. We see this in Shakespeare's Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet, for example. But around the 1770s, we see the more formal introduction of pistols as an optional weapon. And this is ostensibly when we start to see a shift also and standardization of the rules of dueling. You know, we've introduced a new weapon, so we have to have some new standardized rules.
Now, we say ostensibly because there is a certain amount of doubt about how and when these rules get standardized.
Many sources argue that during the Clonmel Summer Assizes in 1777, several Irish gentlemen from Tipperary, Galway, Sligo, Mayo, and Roscommon got together and created the Code Duello.
These rules, once agreed upon, became the standard procedure for Irish duels and then were adopted in England, parts of the continent, and even America.
So the Code Duello is often considered the first standardized rules for dueling with pistols as an option. However, the first mention that we can find of this Irish Code Duello, or the Clonmel Code, is in a memoir from the Irish judge Sir Jonah Barrington, published in 1827, so some 50 years after the code is supposedly established.
So Barrington states in his personal memoir, quote, "This code was not circulated in print, but very numerous written copies were sent to the different county clubs and etc. My father got one for his sons, and I transcribed most, I believe not all, of it into some blank leaves. These rules brought the whole business of dueling into a focus and have been much acted upon down to the present day. They called them in Galway the 36 Commandments."
And if you are thinking of the 10 Dual Commandments from Hamilton, I wouldn't be surprised if this Code Duello and the idea of dual commandments influenced Lin-Manuel Miranda. Just saying.
Barrington, who personally participated in a duel with pistols in 1780, also mentions in a different memoir that he and his opponent had reason to consult their Code Duello rules during their appointment. It's pretty funny because this account reads a bit like a farce. And it's this ridiculous attitude that also, in part, draws a certain amount of doubt on Barrington's account. He was known to write amusing memoirs, so there's a possibility that his account of his own duel and of the Code Duello is more an exaggeration or satire of the stereotype of the stage Irishman's propensity for fighting.
Right. Well, and Richard Brinsley Sheraton's personal account of his own duels, and then using that in his own famous satirical duels in the play The Rivals, which was published in 1775, did not help that stereotype at all, right? It's a play about dueling from an Irishman. There's a stage Irish character in it named Sir Lucius O'Trigger. There's definitely this built-in stage Irish motif that's happening.
So again, we can't find an original copy of this Code Duello because, according to Barrington, they were all just handwritten until he published them in his memoir many decades later. We also can't find any other references to the Code Duello in other books on dueling from the era. So it's not really possible to fact-check Barrington's story or his memory of the codes as it apparently existed. And even he says in his memoir that he transcribed most, I believe not all, so...
Right.
That already is sort of like, there might be some things missing. So, if anyone is aware of one of these handwritten copies of the code, preferably dated, please let us know, because we would love to see it.
I mean, in all sincerity, I am just dying to get my hands on this. So please, please let us know. So anyway, tons of researchers have referenced Barrington's Code Duello as the standardized rules. So we are going to proceed in that vein. We won't list all of the coded commandments. Barrington only lists 25, with the addition of two Galway articles. So we won't be doing all of the rules, but we'll give you a broad sketch of the rules of engagement for a duel.
Okay, so once an offense was given and a challenge delivered, the person who gave the offense could apologize and that would resolve everything. Otherwise, the duelist would name seconds, people who would step in if needed. And there's a whole guide for being a second in a duel published in 1793 by a late captain in the army and aptly titled General Rules and Instructions for All Seconds in Duels. So there was a handbook not just for dueling, but for being the second in a duel.
Right. This got intricate. That's what this is signaling, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the seconds would try to see if there was any way to reconcile the dispute. For example, in Rule 3 of the Code Duello, quote, if a doubt exists, who gave the first offense, the decision rests with the seconds. If they won't decide or can't agree, the matter must proceed to two shots or to a hit if the challenger require it. So, you know, there's a lot of responsibilities if you're going to be a second.
So again, first, there's an offense, then a challenge is delivered. The person who did the offense can apologize. If that doesn't work out, then we name seconds. Then the seconds basically try to play mediator and try to like get things resolved. And then if that doesn't work, now we go to the actual duel. And then there's a whole list of protocols that the seconds would arrange, like getting a doctor to observe the procedure, ensuring the quality of the weapons, whether swords or pistols, etc. It's like organizing a work meeting or something.
Yes. You know, this is something we're assigning to John. And then, you know, we need so-and-so to do this. Yeah, there's a list of responsibilities.
Yeah, it's very much like, send me a Google Calendar invite for our duel.
Yes, I like it. So much more convenient that way, right? Could this duel be an email? That's the question.
Yes, exactly. Could this duel really could have been an email?
Well, it seems appropriate, honestly. Okay, so let's get into a couple more of these rules, right? So the person who was challenged got to choose the weapons. So this would be, you know, I choose swords or pistols, etc. The person who issued the challenge chose the location for the duel.
I just have to say, like, if I'm challenged to a duel, I'm choosing rock, paper, scissors. That is the appropriate choice of weapon. I don't understand.
Obviously, that's a go-to move.
Pistols and swords? I don't think so. Rock, paper, scissors. Come on. What are we doing?
Dance off. That's what I'm
choosing. Yes, exactly. Yes. Yes. Dance off. 100%. So, a few more rules from the Code Duello. Rule number 7. But no apology can be received in any case after the parties have actually taken their ground without exchange of fire. So if you're going to apologize, you have to do it in the proper order. Like, you can't arrive at the duel and be like, actually, I kind of changed my mind. I'm really sorry. Can we not do this?
Yeah. Yeah. Rule 7 says no. Can't do that. Rule 8 says that in the above case, no challenger is obliged to divulge his cause of challenge, if private, unless required by the challenge, so to do before their meeting. So if you haven't asked, like, why are we dueling before you get to the dueling space, no tape backsies. Like, you don't have to explain yourself.
Rule 13. No dumb shooting or firing in the air admissible in any case. The challenger ought not to have challenged without receiving offense. And the challenged ought to have made an apology before he came on the ground. Therefore, children's play must be dishonorable on one side or the other and is accordingly prohibited.
I like the way that that's phrased, children's play.
Mm-hmm. We are men.
Right? I mean, the rule kind of makes sense, right? Like, if you weren't serious about this duel, then why are we here?
Right. Why are we play acting at something so serious?
Right. But at the same time, this rule is kind of contentious because there is definitely a tradition of deloping or firing in the air on purpose. But this rule is saying, no. Don't come with pistols unless you're serious.
Rule 16. The challenged has the right to choose his own weapon unless the challenger gives his honor. He is no swordsman. After which, however, he cannot decline any second species of weapon proposed by the challenged.
And then Rule 17 kind of goes with this and says the challenged choosing his ground, the challenger chooses his distance, the seconds fix the time and terms of firing. So, like, everybody gets to choose some part of this duel. Like, we all get a fair chance to decide how to do this thing.
The challenged gets home court advantage, and the challenger gets to, like, decide on distance, and the seconds, I guess, are over here just doing administrative details.
Yes. They are the administrators, 100% mediators and administrators.
Again, could have been an email. This duel could have been an email. In addition to all of these documented rules, there were some unspoken rules. According to Banks, pistols were to remain smoothbored. Parties were expected to raise weapons and fire in one movement without pausing for steady aim. And practice beforehand was frowned upon. So, like...
Right? Yeah, I love that. It's like, don't actually aim precisely. Don't practice. But also, meet me at dawn. So let's move away from the rules of dueling and move it kind of into this cultural context of the period. It's kind of hard sometimes to really understand just how prevalent dueling was during the late 18th and early 19th century, but we do have some stats and figures from Banks based on reports of dueling in the newspapers of the era, which we love these kind of primary sources.
Yes. Banks reports 579 accounts of duels of British subjects reported in the Times from 1785 to 1820. He goes on to point out that, quote, "I have excluded those reports subsequently shown to have been false or else so replete with stock comic motifs that I feel confident in regarding them as apocryphal. That is to say, duels where the parties or seconds are not named and where the tale is clearly related in a comic fashion." So he's, you know, he's culling the data and basically being like, well, that seems a bit fishy.
So he gives us a few more figures. Here he says, quote, "Between 1785 and 1844, some 277 duelists were reported killed, 16.6% of the total. And in addition, 341 were reported wounded, making an average death or injury rate of 37%. From 1785 to 1804, some 41% of participants were recorded as killed or wounded. From 1805 to 1824, the figure was 43%. But from 1825 to 1844, the rate declined to just 23%.
There was a distinct increase in duels during the Napoleonic Wars. After 1815, there is a steep decline in duels. According to Banks, quote, "A high percentage of duels during the Napoleonic Wars were fought by military officers because a larger proportion of gentlemen held commissions during that period. In addition, it seems that military life was peculiarly productive of the types of disputes that led to duels. The late Georgian elite were both competitive and jealous over honors and promotions. In military service, it was impossible to not requite a slur, and there were many cases of officers who had failed to respond to an insult appropriately being ostracized by fellow officers or even dismissed from their ships or regiments." If you, like, were actually...
like, level-headed.
Level-headed enough to be like, this is a really bad idea. Everyone's like, you can't, what? Do not fight a duel? Be gone with you.
Catch 22. It's absolutely ridiculous. There was also a high rate of dueling in Paris, as Carolee Erickson points out in her book, Our Tempestuous Day, A History of Regency England. And she writes, "The dueling that went on between the French and English officers in Paris was, in a sense, fratricidal. The men were fighting for the honor of their countries, but under rules that bound them together as gentlemen, regardless of country." So again, just tied by rules that seem really arbitrary while also, like, in the middle of a war.
Dueling dropped off in England around the 1830s. People were really sick of them, big surprise. And we even see a huge spike in caricatures of duelists in the 1820s. But it was still really popular in Europe through the remaining 19th century.
So this wouldn't be a complete account of duels if we didn't give you a couple of at least examples, right? So dueling was fairly prominent and high profile. Like, not everyone was dueling, but no aristocratic person was really exempt, right? So there are examples of cabinet ministers and even the prime minister dueling during this era.
We also have examples of dueling over really unexpected things. So challenges were issued over poetry. Sir Thomas More, we're looking at you. And even Almack's vouchers. And if you said, what, Almack's vouchers? Just you wait. Venetia Murray in An Elegant Madness, High Society in Regency England, states that one man challenged Lord Jersey to a duel because Lady Jersey had refused to give his wife a voucher. Lord Jersey declined to fight, saying that he could not be held responsible for his wife's decisions in social matters. Sound judgment, Lord Jersey. I'm on your side.
Oh my gosh. It's just, it's so over the top, right? How dare she not issue a voucher?
To the hallowed halls of Almack's, I challenge you to a duel. I would love to know what Lord Jersey's, what his facial expression looked like.
Like his initial reaction, just
yeah,
being
like
what?
What? What is happening?
Thanks, but no thanks. I will not be dueling with you over that.
So now it's time to bring this all back to Austen and Sense and Sensibility. We now know some of the rules and context around dueling in the era, so now we need to give context for Colonel Brandon and Willoughby and their appointment.
So here is the quick refresher. In February of the novel, Willoughby seduces Eliza in Bath. She's Brandon's ward, daughter of his first love, also named Eliza. In October, Eliza writes a letter to Brandon about her condition. Again, she was seduced and abandoned by Willoughby. She's now 8 months pregnant with his child, and Brandon has been searching for her, so he immediately sets off to go to her.
Weirdly, Willoughby is also called away 2 weeks after this.
Wonder why?
Juliet McMaster, in her article, Good Punishes Bad, The Duels and Sense and Sensibility, points out that neither man can identify a date of possible return, suggesting that both are thinking, I might be dead because of the inevitable duel.
So this sequence of events is also explained by Vince Bruton in his article, He to Defend, I to Punish, Silence and the Duel in Sense and Sensibility. So he writes, the discovery of Eliza is a consequence of the search instituted by Colonel Brandon. Mrs. Smith's discovery occurs in spite of Willoughby's attempt to conceal his relations with Eliza from his wealthy benefactor. One discovery leads to action, the other to defense. The colonel's departure is active, Willoughby's reactive. Likewise, the resulting encounter between the two men bears a comparable, antithetical structure. He to defend, I to punish. Kind of love the way that that's set up. Linguistically, the way that he points that out, but it is very true that Colonel Brandon is active, Willoughby reactive throughout this.
Bruton also gives us a pretty good idea of what the next steps would have been within the dueling protocols of the day. Quote, the Colonel presumably challenges Willoughby, probably in writing and through an intermediary as is done in duels. Willoughby responds and accepts, also through an intermediary, or second, who, in correspondence with Brandon's second, negotiates time, place, weapons, number of shots, and the other practical features of the duel.
Those administrative duties, they never stop.
Really good administrative assistance, yes.
So now we come to the question of whether they would have met using swords or pistols. Fencing was still popular in this era, as we see in Darcy's fencing workout in the 1995 Pride and Prejudice. Thank you, Andrew Davies. Willoughby, as an aspiring, fashionable young man, would have likely had a fencing master or a club in London. And since Brandon is a soldier, he would also be very familiar with that weapon.
However, it is most likely that they met with pistols. Willoughby would get to choose the weapons, and, I mean, if he's smart, he wouldn't want to challenge a soldier with swords, since that is more of an active skill set for Brandon, who might have used the sword in deadly combat.
And according to McMaster, quote, the clincher is the fact that Brandon and Willoughby returned from the duel unwounded. Pistols were still unreliable, and it was not unusual for both principals to miss each other. A duel with swords, however, did not end until one or both principals were blooded, disabled, or dead. I just roll my eyes every time. Just like, okay.
Pistols are like greater risk, greater possible reward. The reward being you don't die.
Yeah. But the risk being, you know, you have murdered someone.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So we know that, according to Brandon, both men leave the field without serious injury. So what happened there? It is unlikely, given the seriousness of the reason they are dueling, that either man would have deloped. According to Bruton, quote, one may speculate that Brandon, as the challenger and avenger of Eliza Williams' wrongs, he, that is, to punish, would not hesitate to kill his man. Colonel Brandon's narration to Eleanor of Eliza's story contains the three essentials of Willoughby's dishonorable usage. He had left the girl whose youth and innocence he had seduced, in a situation of the utmost distress, with no credible home, no help, no friends, ignorant of his address.
I mean, those are not small things that Willoughby has done.
And also told her, I'll be back, and then never came back.
Yeah. No defense for Willoughby here. And yet there is no clear resolution from this meeting between Willoughby and Brandon. Again, we get from the text, both returned unwounded. It is most likely that both men took their shots, but missed. This lack of resolution is likely a form of criticism from Austen. This whole encounter is largely useless. Nothing really happens. Nothing is really resolved except an abstract concept of male honor.
Bruton seems to agree when he writes, the duel between Brandon and Willoughby concerns only the interests and needs of the participants, and not the person on whose behalf the contest is actually fought. Like, nothing about this is designed to actually help Eliza.
Yeah, Eliza's situation would not be improved and could have, in fact, been made materially worse if Brandon were killed. Or, you know, Willoughby, who's the father of her child. Like, this isn't going to end well for anyone if Eliza is actually the one that they're really thinking of. If one of them had been killed, the other one would have had to run away to Europe to avoid legal punishment because dueling was illegal at this time. And so, yeah, this was not done truly to benefit Eliza.
You get the sense that Austin and Eleanor think that this was kind of a stupid male gesture when she writes, "Eleanor sighed over the fancy necessity of this, but to a man and a soldier, she presumed not to censure it." You could just imagine Eleanor being like, "Okay, really, you know?"
But. Yeah, internally like rolling her eyes, but also just being like, "It's done. All right, whatever."
I mean, it's the fancied necessity, like that particular verbiage there that I think jumps out.
Yeah.
And I think especially when you think about the idea that if this is all about sort of like settling your honor, okay, so now that Willoughby has gone and fought this duel and he's done his honorable duty, is he like now a good guy?
Absolved from this now?
Should he still be accepted into polite society? And like, in my opinion, no. But apparently, yeah, because he did what he needed to do. He went and fought a duel. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, seriously, there's so many legitimate reasons for Austin and Eleanor to both be just like, what is going on? And so, like, to round out this discussion of the duel in the novel, we should definitely ask why Austin would include the scene if it's so brief and she seems so dismissive of dueling in general. And I think that this really comes down to these questions about the patriarchal system that has failed women in this novel.
According to Susanna Fullerton's article, The Many Duels of Sense and Sensibility, quote, "The plot of Sense and Sensibility originates in a primal moment, a patriarchal failure masked by the circumstances of the routine operation of primogeniture." So this is a reference to the way the Dashwood women are left without a home, and with John Dashwood's lack of interest in financially supporting them. See the recent episode on annuities for more on that.
Yeah, and Bruton also nails this point when he writes, "The duel is essential to Austin's work of exposing the instabilities brought about by seduction when male protectors inadequately fulfill their roles." And it's just this idea of men inadequately fulfilling their roles is a very obvious theme throughout this novel.
Fullerton also points out that Austin seemed much more interested in, quote, "the ways in which women fought for their security and happiness." She mentions the duels between Eleanor and Lucy Steele specifically, which we love since we discussed this as well in our previous episode on Lucy's filigree. So, like they're dueling in a different sort of way.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the way that Fullerton kind of talks about this, and I think that this makes sense. She says, "The greatest duels in Sense and Sensibility are those fought between Eleanor Dashwood and the so aptly named Lucy Steele. Both women are fighting for their futures. Their duels are fought over what really matters in their lives."
Moving from that to how this shows up in some of Austin's other works, the adaptations, etc., we do see dueling in the 1995 adaptation of Sense and Sensibility, but not in the way you'd expect. So according to Fullerton, quote, "It's a lovely touch in the 1995 Sense and Sensibility that a male character, Edward Ferris, teaches a female, the young Margaret, how to duel and comes off worse." Especially Edward Ferris in that adaptation. Yeah, it tracks.
Yes.
Also because Margaret in that adaptation is really the best character in the movie. Like, I love her.
Undoubtedly.
She's so great.
Unreservedly, yes.
Yeah.
So there's this idea that he's incompetent in that scene. And it's just like, why? Why would he do this?
When she pokes him in the stomach, it's great.
Yes. It's kind of a fantastic moment. It plays really well. But it's interesting, I think, to me that in that particular adaptation, that's the duel that we see. And it's Margaret and Edward. Obviously, that's not the case in the Andrew Davies adaptation, which does actually include like a full scene that is drama between Willoughby and Brandon. And in this one, we do actually have them dueling with swords, again, because I think it's just more
cinematic.
Cinematic, yes. And we do actually see Brandon drawing first blood with a small injury to Willoughby's arm. So this tends to give us this idea that there's some satisfaction in the duel. And I'm using that with like very strong reservations, right?
Big air quotes here, okay?
Yeah, Yeah. But like, but in his version of it, I mean, I do appreciate that he was like, okay, that is a thing that happens in the text and I am justified putting it on the screen. But at the same time, the fact that, you know, it's with swords, that we do get some idea that Brandon has had some sort of justice delivered here. It's kind of, I mean, it makes for good film, but it also, it kind of undercuts maybe what Austin was doing with this idea that duels aren't really worth the screen time.
Yeah, yeah. There are also a couple of references to dueling in The Juvenalia and Lady Susan. But the other reference to dueling that we want to make special note of is a direct mention. So like the word duel is actually used in Pride and Prejudice. Mr. Bennet has gone to London to search for Lydia and Wickham, and Mr. Gardner is also headed to London. Quote, when he was gone, they were certain at least of receiving constant information of what was going on, and their uncle promised at parting to prevail on Mr. Bennet to return to Longbourn as soon as he could, to the great consolation of his sister, who considered it as the only security for her husband's not being killed in a duel.
Oh, Mrs. Bennet.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, basically she's terrified that Mr. Bennet is going to challenge Wickham and then that he is going to be killed in a duel. Not an unreasonable fear, all things considered, but also... It is like a moment where like we are all invited to roll our eyes at Mrs. Bennet.
Well, it's an example again of like sort of Brandon and Willoughby's duel in many ways making it all about them. This is sort of like Mrs. Bennet's kind of making this all about her in this moment.
Yes.
So.
Yes. What will happen if Mr. Bennet dies in a duel? She's not actually thinking about Lydia in that moment.
Again, a not unreasonable fear, but perhaps going on about it while everybody is running around, trying to get stuff ready for travel, get things taken care of is maybe not helpful in that moment.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yes. Well, and Fullerton points this out as well. And she writes, in Pride and Prejudice, Jane Austen refuses to treat dueling as a grand romantic gesture of masculine bravado, instead turning it into comedy. I think that's a very apt description of what she's doing there. Dueling would serve no real purpose in this moment, and so we're allowed to laugh at the idea of a duel when Mrs. Bennet brings it up.
Well, if you have any thoughts on duels or dueling, or like we said, you know of one of these handwritten copies of the Code Duello, please get in touch with us. You can find us on Instagram at thethingaboutaustin and on Twitter at austin_things. You can also check out our website, thethingaboutaustin.com, and email us at thethingaboutaustin@gmail.com. And you can also check out our merch for the podcast on Redbubble. Go to aboutaustin.redbubble.com.
Stay tuned for next episode when we'll be talking about Emma's Portrait of Harriet with our guest, Georgie Castilla.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.